With a little help from Saturday Night Live, I'd like to take you back to the year 2006 for a taste of where we were as a culture with social media back then.
What's up, everybody? I am pumped to welcome you to the Learning Annex's MySpace and You seminar. Today we're going to help you guys set up a MySpace page so that you can communicate with the more than 6 million young people currently in the MySpace community.
The young hip teacher scans the classroom and sees a bunch of middle-aged students, an attractive put-together mom, and a bunch of creepy-looking dudes.
Huh, you know, this is a slightly older group than I was expecting.
Well, I admit I'm not here to start my own MySpace page. My daughter is spending all of her time on it, so I thought I should see what all this hullabaloo was about.
Okay, and the rest of you?
What she said?
Fair enough. Now, the first step in creating your MySpace page is to fill out your profile, things like your name, sex, and age.
Now, with the age thing, could my child put a different age than his actual age?
Yeah, I guess they could.
And MySpace doesn't have a way to police that?
Not really.
So if my son was 45, he could say he was 15?
Your son is 45?
I said if he was 45. It's hypothetical.
Our fears and cluelessness about social media may have changed, but they have not gone away. If anything, they've multiplied since then. We're not just worried about individuals taking advantage of how much we share on these platforms. Now it looks like entire nations are doing it. Add to that the general time suck of social media, and you can understand why there's so much talk of logging off. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today's show is inspired by growing movements for social media fasts and for deleting accounts altogether. With all the reasons to do it, what's stopping you? 816-235-2888. Or have you jumped ship? Tell us about it. What do you miss or not miss? 816-235-2888. My first guest is Shondalise Duster. Shondalise is a digital reporter for NBC and MSNBC. Hi, Shondalise.
Hello, Gina. Good morning.
Good morning. The big news this week is that the NAACP called for a mass log-off of Facebook. Can you explain that?
Yes. So on Tuesday, the NAACP started a digital protest called Log Out Facebook and Log Out Instagram, in which they are calling on social media users, their followers, and their partners to log out of Facebook and Instagram for a week. And this is in protest to the Senate intelligence reports that were released earlier this week that shows that they found that Russians were using the platform of Facebook and Instagram to suppress the African-American vote by targeting them with ads and Facebook pages and that sort of thing.
Yeah, the idea being to keep people home from voting on Election Day, the presidential election in 2016.
Yes, absolutely. So in these reports, researchers found that Russians set up about 30 Facebook pages that were targeting African Americans. And with that, they also found that Russians set up around 10 YouTube channels that posted over 500 videos related to police brutality against African Americans. And the analysis also shows that the Russians made posts and pages that preyed upon the anger with certain issues within the African American community, such as poverty, police brutality, and high levels of incarceration. And they found also that they pushed these messages that said that the best way to fight these issues was, like you said, to not vote and to just stay at home and focus on other issues.
Is there any sense of where the Russians who did this got their information about what Black people in America would likely be riled up about and discouraged by? Was that also Facebook?
Some people that are criticizing this are saying that this was because of Facebook, having the access to so many people's data and their information being given to so many different type of entities and companies. And then some people are saying that you go on the news, on the internet, there's so much information going around about, you know, what people are concerned about, what people are hoping to have their issues in their various communities changed. But a lot of people are pointing this to social media giants like Facebook.
And it's also, as I understand it from the NAACP's press release about this, it's also about this larger history of data hacks, which they say have tended to unfairly target users of color. Can you talk about that piece of it?
Yes. So what the NAACP and other civil rights organizations are saying in essence is that this isn't just about Russia, that this has been a longstanding history within Facebook's culture itself. Earlier this year, there were reports that came out that some of the advertisers on Facebook were targeting people of color and other underrepresented communities regarding, posting ads about housing. You know, they were saying that was discrimination there. And then they were also looking at the discrimination in terms of, voter registration, which was back in the 2016 presidential election. But their deeper concern extends beyond just the data and the privacy hacks. They're also looking at the internal culture within Facebook itself. There's been a lot of calls when it comes to diversity and inclusion. There was a former employee whom I spoke with, Mark Lucky. I spoke with him last month when he published his memo about how it was working at Facebook, and he said that Facebook had a Black people problem.
Can you say more about that?
Yes. So he said that in his memo, he said that the company had a Black people problem, and he talked about the issues that he faced as an employee of Facebook in one particular instance of how when he would walk around on the campus in California at their headquarters, that he would walk by a certain colleague that was not of color, and they would think that he was possibly going to rob him or something like that, because they would hide their keys, or if they had some change, tuck it in their pockets and probably go around a longer way, and that sort of thing. He also talked about how there was only a handful of people in his, department when it comes to certain issues, when they speak up about issues of diversity and inclusion, how they felt that they weren't necessarily being heard. And he also was talking about where he knew people who use Facebook, and they would post something, maybe something just in a disagreement about, politics, or post something and how it would be flagged as hate content. Because now Facebook has a feature where you can report posts that are offensive and that sort of thing, and it would be flagged as hate speech, when actually in reality it wasn't. And he said that this was being done particularly to African Americans. And he also said that whenever he went to HR to address his concerns as an employee regarding diversity and inclusion and how he was viewed among his peers and the concerns that he expressed, he said that HR would basically just say, brush it under the rug, and he felt that it was tone deaf. And he said that this isn't something that just recently started. He said that he felt that this has been part of the DNA of Facebook since it launched years and years ago. He said when you look at the people who first started Facebook were white and Asians, that it wasn't always inclusive of African Americans. And this was his point of view and his take on this.
So the movement people are talking about this week it begins with a hashtag. It's hashtag log out Facebook. Can you say more about what that is and what that's asking of people, how popular it is, et cetera?
So yes, hashtag log out Facebook, as I mentioned, is started by the NAACP. And what they are doing is they're using this week-long hashtag to try to call attention and show Facebook that the protection of the privacy and the data of the users of color are important, and they want them to make it a priority. So
showing them what they stand to lose, in a way.
Yes, in a way, showing them what they stand to lose. Because if you there was a report that came out with Pew Research recently that talked about how many people of color use Facebook, and the majority of people who use Facebook are people of color. And so what the NAACP wants Facebook to do, even though they released the civil rights audit, it was some So when I spoke with President NAACP President Derek Johnson, he was telling me about how, you know, they had been working with Facebook, them and other civil rights organizations, to try to help them implement strategies to better be more inclusive, things that are concerning to them on the platform itself, including the hacks and the voter suppression attempts by Russians and other organizations. And he also mentioned that one of the things that they want them to do is, okay, you released the update to the civil rights audit, which they started 6 months ago, but are you taking it, they want Facebook to really, really take it seriously and to just not have it as part of a media attention because Facebook is facing so much backlash right now. Are they really, he said the next step is Facebook really, really going to take this seriously, the recommendations that have been given to them and what is outlined in the civil rights audit that they have? Are they really going to make it a priority? And he said that his organization is willing to continue working with Facebook on this.
So what's the likelihood that this actually changes anything? I mean, how do we have numbers on how big the size of participation?
Well, we don't have the size and the number of participation on this, but when you do look at the hashtags themselves, log out Facebook and log out Instagram, you do see where there are celebrities and other organizations who are participating. For example, Ben and Jerry's logged out for a day. You had Amy Schumer said that she was also participating. You have other organizations that have also said that they are going to participate in this. And when you also look at it, some people are saying, why is this just a week-long protest? Some people have said, I'm deactivating my Facebook account forever. I'm never going back to Facebook. And it seems that this is not even just limited to the NAACP's push with their own week-long protest. You've even seen some notable people over the past couple of days that just say they can't trust Facebook anymore. You have some journalists that have even said that they are logging out of Facebook. You have Walt Mossberg, who said that he said that, you know, after being with the platform 12 years, that he was logging off. A colleague of mine.
I want to follow up on that because also this is not the only movement to step back from social media and not just Facebook, mm-hmm. but the whole shebang. Can you talk about some of the other movements and trends and the motivations behind them?
Oh, when you look at some of these trends where, you know, you've even seen delete Facebook now. It's like so many different hashtags that are coming up now. It seems that it's like a snowball effect. Because as there's more reports that are coming out that, for example, Facebook issued an apology Friday because there was a report that came out that some unpublished photos and companies got access to some unpublished photos on Facebook from millions of users. And then there's also there's a report that Facebook gave access to over 150 companies user information outside of what was authorized to them, that they had more information, more people's information than what they said. So now you're finding that people don't trust the platform at all. And they're going to other platforms such as Twitter. Some people, you know, there's not really, you know, much going on with Snapchat, but people still use Snapchat. And then you're seeing that Facebook is not really popular among younger people, younger generations of people. They're using other types of platforms, like they're using YouTube, and then, you know, even Twitter is getting a bigger presence than normal.
You know, I'm also seeing this trend of people for just personal sanity backing off from social media altogether.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are people who just said, this is too much, I need to take a break, especially when you look at what happened during the 2016 presidential election. There was many different ads and posts and things being shared. I even had someone tell me they don't know what they can trust anymore. It's saying they feel that they have to fact check, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Because they just feel that it's so many things that are being shared on Facebook and Instagram. You know, someone will see a photo with some words and then they'll take it at face value and you'll share it. And then you'll come back and say, well, that's not necessarily true. And Facebook has said, you know, even in a civil rights audit, that one of the things that they've tried to improve is content moderation, you know, giving users the opportunity to report things that they think is false. Even with this most recent election, reporting things that they thought was not true regarding their voting precincts and election officials being able to say, hey, this may be an attempt of voter, you know, suppression. But people are finding that I don't know who to trust. I need to take a break.
But is it too late to turn back the clock on the influence of social media or on our reliance on it? I mean, if I think about just myself, you know, if I need to get a hold of someone, a phone book is not going to help me the way it might have mm-hmm. once upon a time. As a journalist, mm-hmm. if I get off of Facebook, I lose access to sources, event news, and I'm sure other people have equivalent hangups in their own lives.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's Facebook, as we see, has become such an integral part of everyone's lives, especially if you've been with the platform since it first started so many years ago when you had to be in college to have your college email address to log in and get an account with the platform. And so many people have so many memories and posts, and they've made so many connections. People find it easier to connect with their families and friends without having to pick up the phone or remember a phone number like we used to have to do back in the day. You know, some people are, you know, I haven't, you know, really seen people saying that they're going to revert back to the old ways of, like you said, carrying a little pocket phone book where they can just call someone or send them a text message. Some people are saying, oh, well, we're logging out of Facebook. Do we have another platform that we can go to? I've seen a little bit of that conversation. Some people have brought up, we talked about, you know, your MySpace earlier. You know, is there going to be another MySpace? Is there going to be another social networking giant that can take on Facebook?
Well,
but like you said,
yeah.
Go ahead.
I want to put this to our listeners. I mean, if you've thought about getting off of social media, give us a call. Talk to us about what you're afraid you'll lose and what you would hope to gain. 816-235-2888. We all maybe wonder what we might accomplish with the time that would be freed up by a social media fast. Well, wonder no more. A researcher at KU has looked into it, and he is here to share some insights. Jeff Hall, good morning.
Good morning.
What inspired you to look into this?
Well, this is one of those questions that is pretty fundamental. People have been, right as your conversation has been going, people have been wondering, what does social media time do to you? You know, is it a positive thing? Is it a negative thing? But the question about what would we be doing otherwise is a really important question to answer as well. And to my knowledge, no one had done a study prior to figure out what people would do with that time if they weren't on social media.
So how did you study it?
So we approach this with not just Facebook, and I know the conversation so far has been dedicated to that, but
yeah,
also
but broaden out. That's good.
That's right. It was on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Snapchat. Those are the big four in terms of people's usual use of social media. However, we also asked participants in the study to refrain from using any other social media that we didn't name. So what we did is we recruited people, and these were adults as well as some college students. The final sample had about a third college students and then a lot of working adults and single moms and stay-at-home moms and retirees and things like that. And we recruited them to participate for a full month, 28 days. And they were randomly assigned to four different conditions, whether stay off of social media for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And then also a group that was no change in their normal social media use. And then what we did is at the end of every single day, we had individuals tell us what did they do during the day. So they had all of these different categories drawn from what's called the American Time Use Survey, which was done by the U.S. Department of Labor. And that looks at how we allocate our time on any given day. And then we had categories that were specific to media. So how much time do you spend on the internet, on social media, video games, and then, of course, television, but that's already on there. And then what we did is when people said what they did every single day of that time that they were off of social media or while they were on social media, we also asked them, how did you feel today? Was it a great day? Was it just a so-so day? Basically, things that measure effective well-being and quality of day. And so the study was set up so that we could compare people who were on and off of social media on any given day, but also compare people to themselves. So if you were in the study and that you were on social media for a week, and then you were off for 2 weeks and then back on again, we could compare your habits or your behaviors within yourself.
Okay. What did you find? This is fascinating. I mean, Where does the time people used to spend liking each other's posts actually go, and how does that make them feel?
Right. Where does the time go? That's a great question. Well, part of the motivation for this was really interesting. You know, you and I have spoken before about what people do with their time in terms of relationship building and friendships. And one of the major questions that's driven research on displacement before has been the idea that if we're not on social media, we would actually be in these deep, in-depth conversations face-to-face with our friends and family.
Over coffee. And,
right, over coffee. Or perhaps we're going to finish that novel, or we're going to pick up a foreign language. You know, something really important and meaningful if we weren't wasting our time otherwise. What was interesting about this study was that there are four activities that really seemed to change when people were off of social media. The first one was people browse the internet more, and that makes a lot of sense. Once people removed the different things off their phone, for example, the apps, or off their desktop, which is what we requested they do when they were abstaining, they just turned and opened the browser and then looked on something else instead. And that was the largest change in terms of what's called effect size, which is a statistical measure of what happens between groups.
So it's like chewing gum instead of cigarettes.
Right, exactly. It's actually
the most similar activity.
You got it. And what's curious is that past studies of internet displacement, right, so they were done in the aughts, that looked at what people would do if they weren't on the internet, found that they were replacing other media as well. So they were using the internet instead of watching television. And television replaced things like going to the cinema and listening to the radio.
But this is interesting to me, because that means that if you're not replacing it with other communication, then what it is primarily is not actually communication, it's media consumption, which is different from communication.
You've got it. And media consumption, thinking of internet use and social media as more similar to media consumption broadly, I think is much more accurate in terms of how we use social media. I mean, the conversation right before this is kind of case in point. Political information, you know, all kinds of voter suppression actions, all of these things are actually about media, broadly speaking. But we think in terms of interpersonal relating to one another, that's really a small portion of the broader kind of scheme of what social media does.
But you also found, if I may, one other thing people were doing with that time.
Well, actually, three others. One was working. So people very commonly say that working is something that they did when they were off of social media. And that was a very large category as well. In a recent poll in 2016, 54% of Americans said that they use social media to kind of recharge their batteries at work. And our study really kind of confirmed the idea that once off of social media, they went back to working. But the other two are a lot more curious. They were cooking and cleaning, so cleaning your house, and watching your kids. So what was fascinating about those to me was here were cases in which that people perhaps, if we take two, maybe all three of those ones that I just mentioned together, it could be that people are using social media to avoid things that they prefer not to be doing. Now, I'm not saying people don't like watching their kids, but I am saying perhaps
they don't like
that they're
washing their dishes.
They do not like washing their dishes, exactly.
Well, we have to take a little break, but if you've tried to break free of social media, what did you hope would happen, and what was the actual result? If you want to lock off but just can't, what's stopping you? 816-235-2888. You'll be talking with KU researcher Jeff Hall and a digital reporter from NBC and MSNBC. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about getting off of social media. Whether you're motivated by politics or personal betterment, what happens if you do log off, and what's keeping you from trying it? My guests are Shondalise Duster of NBC and MSNBC. She's done a lot of reporting on recent anti-Facebook campaigns. Hi again, Shondalise.
Hello.
And Jeff Hall. He is a communications professor at KU. He's found that the time we don't spend on social media is mostly taken up with other internet browsing activities and work and chores, not FaceTime in the world with our friends, as many of us hope, and certainly not writing the great American novel, sad to say. Hi again, Jeff.
Hey.
So let's hear what our callers want to talk to us about. I want to talk to Jessica, who's with us in Prairie Village. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to share?
I just wanted to share that I have been off social media for about a year. I can say I probably was on Instagram a little bit, but I've been off Facebook for a year. And I would say it has definitely changed my life as far as bringing a little more peace and simplicity I'm a bit of a minimalist, so I feel like with Facebook, you end up managing more than you need to, with more friends and more things to keep up with. So it's definitely simplified my life.
Do you find that you're getting to things like dishes a little faster?
Maybe. I kind of agree that probably internet surfing on the internet for other things may replace what you would be Facebook scrolling, what you'd be scrolling through for through Facebook. But I would say I definitely have more face-to-face time with my children because I'm not looking at my phone as much.
There's not like that instant gratification sitting there in the form of maybe a message from some random person you know.
Yes, absolutely. And again, I think it really is just about, I think in ways Facebook can complicate your life because it's adding more for you to manage.
Interesting. You know, I would like to turn back to Jeff on this because, Jeff, the piece of your research that we haven't gotten into, you talked about that you studied not only what people were doing with their time differently, but also how they felt, you know, when they were on social media and off of it.
Yeah, that's right. So what's interesting what your caller is saying here is that she's speaking to a broader trend in research. One thing that we seem to be finding is that social media use in terms of time spent on it is negatively associated with all kinds of positive outcomes. And it appears that recent research has confirmed that that may be a causal thing, so that actually being on it or off of it, experimentally assigned to one condition or the next, does seem to have that effect. Now, those effects are very small, but they're actually more strong typically with users who are heavy duty users. So people who use it a lot actually have more negative effects and benefit more by getting off of it. So what she's speaking to about it, reducing the complication of your life and those kinds of things, I think other people have found. However, there's a secondary part of this, which she speaks to as well, is that I found with my users, 17% of people who started the study in the study that I did failed to be able to actually stay off of social media, even though they were being paid to do so. So we watched them quite closely and during the study in terms of watching whether they were actually complying with our study protocol. And 17% of the people failed to quit. What this means is that largely social media is deeply habitual. It's really difficult to break that initial habit because we lack kind of self-regulation abilities to do so. That one more message, that one more check-in is really, really powerful. In the open-ended responses to my study, users also said that it was creepily instinctual to want to get back on social media every time that they had a free moment or were transitioning through things at work. They felt it was really weird to finally be without it. You kind of feel like something's missing. But your caller actually had been off for an entire year, and I would guess that kind of the long-term benefits of those things are very different than my participants who are only off for as long as 28 days.
You know, I was a very late adopter of the smartphone, and so I had a flip phone for a much longer time than a lot of other people did. And as a result, I would notice myself in lines out in public looking around and being the only person who was not on my phone. And that's in and of itself sort of neutral information. But what fascinated me about it is that, you know, I came up in this world as a writer. And as a writer, I was thinking, like, what would I do without eavesdropping and watching people? And now that I have a smartphone, I write less, quite honestly.
I think that what's interesting about these kind of ways that they integrate into our lives is that a lot of times these technologies, and I would say that your smartphone is kind of a good way to go with this, is the smartphone is sort of the avenue through which all different kind of communication traffic channels for most people. I was surprised in a recent presentation at the University of Kansas was talking about how few people actually access these kinds of programs and apps and otherwise from desktop or laptop computers. It really seemed that their phone had become the primary mechanism to keep in contact with other people and also keep in touch with the world. And if we think about that, that constant sort of hearkening back to the world of the internet, pay attention to news events, news scores from a football game that you're paying attention to, a text from a friend or your mom, all of these kind of create an amalgam sense of pull to try to get you back into that world. And I would add that, you know, to our earlier point, there have been a lot of very concerning investigations that have suggested that these social media companies know that that's what they're trying to do. They are attempting to get your attention and pull you into the phone. Because you remember, if you're not paying for Facebook, if you're not paying for social media, you are the product. You are the thing that's being sold.
Ew. Okay, Shondalise, jump in here.
Yeah, I find it very interesting listening to both of you, especially, you know, people who, you know, as you were saying, that have been paid, you know, even to try to stay off of Facebook, you know, it's really, really hard for them. You know, as I mentioned earlier, Facebook has played such an integral part in people's lives that some people literally have, you know, their whole life on Facebook. And even sometimes you see that even with what's going on now with the hashtag log out Facebook, you know, I've seen some people, you know, even though it's a week long protest, some people are saying, oh, I'm going to log out for a day, you know, because some people, you know, it's like, you know, you need it so much. You do so much, whether it's playing a game or whether it's your favorite company is having some type of campaign where you can, you know, achieve a certain amount of points or get discounts if you log on to their Facebook page and you type a comment or something like that. Facebook and social media itself has found a way to just have its, I don't want to say claws, but, you know, to just have such a, you know, a stakeholder, just a stake in our lives with so much. And so now, you know, some people are questioning when it comes to the log out Facebook, delete Facebook, this trend that we're seeing on social media, people doing and getting off of the platform itself. Okay, after a week, then what?
Yeah,
what's going to happen?
Let's talk to Anne in Leawood, who has some interesting insights, I feel like. Anne, join the conversation.
Hi, thank you. Yes, my comment was that I work for a management consulting firm, and I manage the social media for 4 doctors' practices on Facebook. How could we get off Facebook when we have that as our communication vehicle to our patients? There are thousands of patients who have signed up to our Facebook page and get information about the practice and new medical tips, that type of thing. So we're kind of in a stuck place, if you will.
Yeah. How do people with this sort of like a service to provide, where people have come to rely on them on Facebook or on another social media platform, how realistic is it for them to step back from that?
Should I step in here?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, I think one way to think about this is it's really hard for us in this present time, you know, right on the precipice of 2019, to remember we've gone through this before, right? When the internet age came, we were thinking, oh my God, what's all going to happen? How is it all going to change? In the early days of instant messaging, people were like, oh, that's replacing everything. And then texting came, and then the smartphone came, etc. There will be another platform. There will be another way in which that we can reach one another. We don't know what that's going to be yet.
But how do we know that it doesn't replicate the things that people are so upset about, though?
Well, unfortunately, we don't. You know, I think that the broader public conversation about whether or not lawmakers or otherwise need to get involved in regulating social media platforms broadly, I think is a very healthy conversation. And as a nation, we need to do that. We need to be speaking out both in these small kind of ways of personal protest, but also more public ways as the, you know, we were talking about in terms of the NAACP. But what I would add to this is, if you think about it, if we're worried about whether or not we're going to find ways to get messages from our doctor or from people who we want to hear from, I believe that we're probably not too far from a platform being developed where someone could just basically say, download my contacts from Facebook, channel them through, but delete out all the other stuff that I don't want to see. Or you can hand select what you want to see, and you can stop Facebook having all the control. It'd be a platform you can add on top of it.
Well, Shondalise, I want Shondalise to jump in here, because as a reporter who covers tech, what's your sense of whether something is being developed, not just to replace these platforms, but also to kind of mine them for the stuff you've put on them and would like to keep?
In a way, you're kind of already seeing some things like that. It's like every day you look up, like I have Apple. You know, there's always some type of new app. You know, it's like it's easy for someone to create an app these days. It seems like we're almost getting to that point that, you know, somebody can say, oh, you can just take this and just migrate it over here, and you could take this here and migrate it over there. I don't think we're far out from that. As he was saying, you know, will it be just like Facebook? I'm not sure, but honestly, when you think about it, it's not just the fact that it's Facebook, right? It's the concept of what Facebook brings. What people like about Facebook is that you log on, it gives you a sense of control. You log on, you can publish whatever you want. And that's just on a broad term of everyone. You can write something, you can publish something, you can play your games. You have a place where you can save your photos. You have a place where you can save your videos. You can upload videos off your smartphone to that. So when you look at what Facebook has to offer, people aren't really logging on to Facebook because of the name Facebook. People are logging on to Facebook because of what you do with Facebook.
You know, so I want to go ahead and hear from Anna in KCK, and she's echoing something we hear from Eve, who tweets, "I've used Facebook as a digital baby book," and Eve says she'd pay good money for a tool to crawl through her history and harvest her posts and pictures related to her kids. Anna, what's your story?
Yeah, similarly, not so much a baby book for me to keep track of over time. I mean, I guess I have that on my phone. It's all my family lives, you know, all over the U.S., including both sets of grandparents for my daughter. So that's the way that they see my daughter grow up. And I was, you know, really upset with all the things that happened after the election. And I just was like, I really want to get off Facebook, but I want to be able to share with my family, and that's an easy way. Otherwise, you know, I'm going to have to set up some kind of special...
something that would take a lot more work.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I know you have more to say, but we're running short on time. And what I want our guests to answer about this is, Jeff, in your case, when people couldn't stay off of social media, they couldn't do it for the trial period of your research. Was this a common reason?
Well, when they regretted what they lost, 42% of the people who were in my study who actually stayed on, what they said was they missed that contact. So what Anna was saying there was right on. You know, they felt that way of having a daily check-in of what was happening and other people, particularly geographically distant relatives and friends, was a meaningful thing. So they said that was one thing that they noticed that changed when they were abstaining from social media broadly. We unfortunately didn't follow up on the people who quit the study entirely because they weren't terribly interested in being contacted since they weren't going to be paid. But the bigger picture is correct, right? That this is a dual-edged phenomena, and I really want to focus on that. It's both probably not helping you feel better. It's probably making you feel more lonely or stressed or otherwise. But it also gives you access to people and baby pictures and cat pictures and your friend's dog that's so adorable with that little Santa hat on, and you don't want to miss those things too. So it's not. The problem with these things is it's not all good and it's not all bad. It's largely how you use it.
Well, we have to cut it off there. Jeff, Shondalise, thank you both so much.
It's my pleasure.
You are so very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Our guests have been Shondalise Duster of NBC and MSNBC and Jeff Hall, a communications professor at KU. Keep talking about social media on social media. Our Twitter handle is @KCURCST. Hate the game, not the player. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now, if you still have holiday shopping to do, it may be a little late to order something for guaranteed arrival by December 25th. But is that necessarily a bad thing? There's a whole network of local makers selling handcrafted wares here in town. And sure, a lot of the big holiday markets have passed, but that doesn't mean you can't still connect. My guest to help guide you is Katie Mabry Van Deeren. She runs a really popular maker fair called the Strawberry Swing. Hi, Katie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
So good.
It is December 20th. Yep. How do you make a game plan to connect with a local maker on a time crunch?
There are so many different ways to do it. I feel like Kansas City has kind of exploded in this maker movement. There are things going on tonight, tomorrow. One of them is called Procrastinator Party, I think. It's at a place called the Rhino in the north, like on Swift Road. There's stuff all weekend in the Crossroads, last minute makers, you know, they're hustling.
Tell me the story of how you found and gathered so many people out there working on their own, making things from like food items to throw pillows and jewelry. You had to find out about all of these people,
right?
Just like anyone out there would, because you are like Etsy in human form.
We are Etsy IRL. So basically, it was started, the Strawberry Swing started in 2011. That's kind of when this maker movement, I think, took off. Like people realized, oh, I want to buy something that I can meet the person that made it. And a lot of people thought, maybe I don't want to work in a corporate job and sit in a cubicle. I want to make things with my hands. So that's when the Strawberry Swing started. It was actually started by a woman named Heather Baker, and she moved to Denver in 2013, and that's when I took over. So actually, social media helped me grow it and like find all of these people. That was a way for us to get the word out, get people to apply, me go find people. So Instagram and Facebook really actually helped me.
Give me an example of a local maker who you are excited about, but someone not many other people seem to know. Someone with a product Ooh. That would perhaps make a really sweet Christmas present.
Oh my goodness, there are so many. One that I really love is called Metallic Fern. She makes plants out of crepe paper. So I own about three of these. I've also taken a class and
they can't die.
They can't die, and people think they're real. I've actually almost watered it. And so it's like the gift that keeps on giving because it will never die. She even made mistletoe, like fake mistletoe to hang in your house. She was at the holiday swing.
And so how about, this is like lightning round.
Yes.
Something for an in-law.
Oh my gosh, an in-law. Okay, jewelry, really good. I got my mother-in-law something from Mac Becks. She's amazing. She makes all kind of jewelry. She hand hammers it with brass and actually donates a lot of it to the Period Project, which is to help homeless women get tampons and stuff like that.
And so can you describe that jewelry a little bit more and tell us more of the maker's story?
Yeah, so Matt McKenzie is her name. She actually started with the swing. She was making like brass earrings that had tassels on them. I don't know if you've seen them or not, but it was like a little ovary, but you wouldn't know that unless you knew the background of her. And she donated, I think, all of that percentage to the Period Project. But when I got my mother-in-law, were like beautiful. They kind of looked like little hands with a stone in it. And I just saw Lisa Rodriguez. She had Mac Beck on in the other room.
Cool. Well, what about in our pop quiz, something for a kid?
A kid? Oh, I know that right off the top of my head. There's a girl named Andy. She's, I think, called Shop Andy. I can't remember right now, but it's on my Instagram. She made these adorable little like campfire kits out of felt that she stuffed. So it was like two logs, stones, and then like the flames of the fire all built out of felt that she sewed. And then she had little sticks with felt marshmallows so the kids could pretend they're roasting.
So it's like a tea party only yep. for a campfire.
Yep. I totally got my kids that and they love it.
Something for a significant other.
Ooh, this is a good one. Okay, so we have a lot of makers that are doing leather, red hair leather. She makes really beautiful kind of like dishes that your husband or you could throw your keys, your change, anything when you get home. You know, a place to collect all that that's really
all
beautiful.
That stuff that you all the stuff. Have to put somewhere.
Yes, exactly.
And does it actually make a space look more orderly to
it
have
does.
All
it's
that
beautiful.
Stuff just in a bowl?
It does. I think it does. I love bowls, though. I'm obsessed with baskets and bowls. It makes it look, the chaos look organized.
Do you have an all-time favorite handmade gift that you have received?
Ooh, these are lightning round. I love every gift I've ever received that's handmade. Lately, I got a couple of gifts at the holiday swing that the makers gave me. One pair is these lovely earrings I'm wearing, which we can't see, but they're made by Tucker and Scout. And also, there's really beautiful cards that a lot of my makers have made that have sayings on them that are really inspiring. So like, one of them has a bad word, so I'm not going to say it. You know, they have a lot of like hustle, like, rise and shine. It's time to make your day. You're an entrepreneur. Really great sayings with beautiful decorations on them. I love that kind of stuff.
Can you tell us the name of the maker who does that?
Alyssa J makes them that have a couple of them have curse words in them, but they're really inspiring curse words.
So, you know, when you think about what you love about these handmade gifts, are you able to put your finger on what actually sets them apart? Because somebody came up with the design for a mass-produced gift. Like,
right.
that was somebody's idea. There
right.
is creativity in that. For you, like, as a recipient of a gift, what makes a handmade gift different?
I think it's the fact that you actually know that you are receiving this gift from someone that lives in your community that made that gift, and whoever gave you the gift. Or, for instance, if I'm buying the gift, I love meeting that person. I love knowing that when I buy it from them, it's going right back to them. And so that money will then stay in our economy and that person's family is going to benefit. You know, for instance, with me, I run the local small business. I'm using the money that I make to have my kids be in, you know, extracurricular activity or guitar lesson or, you know, all that tax money too is going right back into our community. So it's really important, I think.
What would you recommend people do if they want to start sort of cultivating their own network of makers who they kind of see as their go-to shops?
Yeah, there are so many ways to do this. We have so many areas in town, but if you want to go online, of course, we have an Instagram that features tons of makers that are part of us, but KC SourceLink, they are a nonprofit here in town. They have created a little guide online that's called Shop Local KC, and you can type in your zip code, and anyone that's, I think that small businesses probably have to apply or contact them to get their business on there. But that's like the only thing I've seen online that's kind of a guide. Otherwise, you can just physically go to certain areas of town. Like I live in Brookside. I love Brookside because it is so shop local. The entire little shopping center of Brookside, I think that was founded like 100 years ago. I'm not exactly sure, but they have 80 local shops right there in 63rd and Main, you know? And you can get everything from, I know for a fact, I go there to get anything I need for my kids' projects at the Brookside Dime Store. I saw them on their social media, they have Santa there tonight. So if you need a last minute present, they've got Santa Claus there. Then you've got shop stuff, like you've got Shop Girls stuff, World's Window. You even have a toy store, which I think that's the hardest thing. Like we talked about that maker that made the toy, but most people can't find toys anywhere but a big box store. So to have a locally owned toy store, I think is so important. And we have one right in Brookside.
What other areas of town would be sort of good, like, spots to just land in and go browsing?
Right. Crossroads at 18th and Wyandotte. There's a plethora of small businesses. The Bauer Building, a lot of our makers have studios in there that they open up. So you can go in like tomorrow night. I know the Bauer Building is having an open studio sale where like Wild Wash, she makes soaps and lotions and Whiskey and Bone. I call them by their business name, but their names are Sarah and Tara. Whiskey and Bone makes jewelry. And then there's a store called Foxtrot. In that same kind of building, you kind of have to go around the alleys. There's just little shops everywhere. Urban Provisions.
This is the building that was once upon a time the arts incubator.
It was, totally. I think that's where the Crossroads started with David Ford and YJ's across the street, which that is now, I think, some kind of local restaurant that you could eat locally, too. We also have the West Bottoms. The West Bottoms is full of local small businesses and recycled stuff. So like the vintage, as we all know, like First Fridays down there is kind of where it is taken off for these vintage revival.
The West Bottoms, would that be like any day of the week you head down there and stuff's going to be open? Is that the situation?
I don't know
now?
If they're always open. I don't know. That's a really
good
question.
Maybe a
weekend
trip.
Definitely this weekend. I know a lot of them will be open if you're procrastinating like a lot of us are. There's also food down there. Casey Pinoy is one of our vendors that normally had a food truck. She just opened a brick and mortar store down there. So you can even get locally owned food down there.
Yeah. So that's something I wanted to talk to you about. Food gifts are very popular these days. Are there local makers in Kansas City who have sort of a food gift service? Like there are like coffee subscriptions and things like that are becoming popular in general. Do you know of anything like that? Some local food gift ideas?
I know that there's a girl who I can't remember her first name, but she's called the Casey Box, I think. And she does different gift boxes of only local made in Casey stuff. And I know you can choose from like probably a coffee lover one or a barbecue lover one. And I know she probably puts like Casey Canning Co. That's one of our local makers who does canned goods. And we even have one of the vendors at our holiday swing who sold out and had to put his, you know, they take money on their iPads. He turned around and put the Chiefs game on. Sunday during event, he sold out of his handmade marshmallows. He makes gourmet, huge marshmallows with different flavors, and he sold completely out.
Did you know, we had someone from the app Black Privilege on earlier this week, and he was talking about just sort of really being deliberate about who you're supporting in the communities where you're circulating your dollars. Right. Is that something that that there's a way for people to be really deliberate about when they are shopping local, thinking about the communities they're supporting as part of that?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Reggie Gray, he is so awesome. He has really started this great app for Black Privilege, and I think we need to see more areas like East Side, like on Truce, where we're all seeing all the condos go up. We're going to also try and get some small businesses in there with Truce Market Collective, and we partner with Reggie because there isn't a lot of storefronts in communities that need a lot of help, you know?
Well, Katie Mabry Van Deren, thank you so much for adding your expertise to people's shopping experiences.
Thank you so much. It was fun.
Katie runs the Strawberry Swing, and she's also part of the Troost Market Collective. That's a wrap for today's show. You can grab either of this morning's conversations later on at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. We talked earlier in the hour about movements to log off of Facebook in social media fasts of all kinds. That's definitely worth a listen. Tomorrow, we'll be doing a portrait session with a man who's been called a poet scientist, Alejandro Sanchez Alvarado. He grew up in Venezuela under the dictatorship there. He came to the U.S. without knowing English, and now he's a principal investigator at the Stowers Institute. He'll share his story tomorrow at 10 on KCUR's Central Standard. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, Chris Young, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.